I have
current geek.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Current Geek. This is the weekly proceedings of the meetings of the Frog Pants All Stars, geeks of the world, and you to keep you current on all things that matter most. I'm Scott Johnson with Tom Merritt.
Oh, hello, Scott Johnson. Is it the weekend already? I'm excited.
Fancy meeting you here. Why are you so excited?
So fancy. I so fancy. I put on a t-shirt instead of my normal collared shirt.
Whoa, look at you.
Yeah. That's fancy for me because I wear a collared shirt to bed.
I see. Casual Friday is what we call this. I like it.
Yeah.
Totally. It's nice to see you as always. I'm excited to get into today's stories. We have guests. Let's start with our first one. You know him, you love him. He's actually a returning guest. He's been on before and a good friend of the network. Let me introduce Joel Duggan. Joel, what's going on?
Not too much, guys. I'm excited to be back.
Yeah, it's good to have you
back.
Welcome
back, man.
Cartoonist.
It's been far too long.
Podcaster. Helping run a rad Kickstarter. We'll talk about that later. I'm very excited for all that stuff. Also with us, Wayne H. Johnson Jr. I'm giving the full name because I just feel like it. He is a filmmaker, special effects artist, and also working on some cool VR stuff, which I'm very excited to talk about later. Welcome to the show, Wayne.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on the show. It's going
to
be fun.
I'm excited to have you guys here. So everyone knows the drill. There's news to talk about. And we get to it with this.
Herbert Hoover, Secretary of Commerce in 1922, finds infant radio facilitates news gathering, as do many others in high public office.
Tom?
Scott? we're going to go down the nostalgia highway today. Nintendo announced the Nintendo Entertainment System, NES Classic.
Whoa.
This is a smaller and also not modular, so it doesn't use cartridges, mini NES that comes with 30 classic games pre-installed, includes Final Fantasy, no number, Final Fantasy, Excitebike, Tecmo Bowl, Super Mario Brothers. Also comes with a replica controller, which you can actually connect to a Wiimote and use with the Wii's virtual console. Mini NES arrives on November 11th for $59.99.
Total, absolute, have to have, will own, no way I'm not getting this thing. It is my childhood and teenage years wrapped up in a tiny little box ready to be plugged HDMI, by the way, into my television, which is rad and cool. You know, I'm a little surprised. Nintendo's method for doing this in the last probably 10 or 15 years has been, we'll let people download old games and they'll pay $5 a pop, and that's how they'll enjoy our retro games. And that's worked to some degree. It's been okay, I suppose. But they've never really done like a collection. It's always been kind of piecemeal game by game. So, Joel, this idea that all of your favorite games from as when you were a kid on the NES in a little tiny NES box without the need to blow any dust off the cartridge, it's a pretty good deal, yeah?
For $60? I mean, a lot of boxes like this are more than $60 on their own. Without any games installed, then you got to go get them, you know, on your own. At first I was like, well, I'm nostalgic for Nintendo, but I don't know what 30 games are they going to put in there. Turns out there's only two that I needed to see, and that was Double Dragon 2 and Super Mario 3.
Oh,
sold.
Wow. Yeah,
I'm on board.
It's not like they skimped too. I was a little bit worried that they were going to not include the kinds of titles people really wanted, like where are the Zelda titles or whatever. And they kind of came through. They put in mostly things people remember liking and loving. Wayne, is this something
Ghosts
that
and Goblins?
Yeah. Oh my gosh, Ghosts and Goblins.
Right.
You know how many quarters I put into that? It's ridiculous.
Right.
Yeah.
Wayne, do you have any thoughts on this thing? $60 is a pretty easy entry price.
Yeah, $60 is great. I'm not sure if they got Akari Warriors because that was my game.
Mm.
Like, you guys ever play that?
That's not on there. That's a good point.
It's not on there. Yeah.
Not on there.
I lost at least 6 months of my life to that game.
Yeah, but there's I see Balloon Fight on there, Tom. Yeah, there's Balloon Fight.
Yeah.
I love Balloon
Fight. All three Super Marios, Super Mario Brothers 2 and 3, and Donkey Kong Jr.
I would argue. I'm just going to say this out loud for those who don't know, and for those that do, you know what I'm talking about. There's Joust, and then there's Balloon Fight. Balloon Fight is better at Joust than Joust was. There, I said it. You send your emails. You can be as angry as you want. It's fine.
Wow. Shots fired, huh?
Yep.
Or should I say Scott's fired?
Whoop! You got it.
At first I looked at this and I was like, $60? Wasn't that Atari 2600 joystick like $20? Turns out no. Turns out the Atari 2600 joystick is $70.
Yeah, and those games,
I feel like it was cheaper at one point, though.
It may have been, but those games are also terrible. So we can be nostalgic all we want about the heady days of the Atari 2600, but at some point we need to all admit, and by the way, I would say this is going to be true now and in the future when we think back on PlayStation 1, those were important consoles and important times in video games, but they were terrible. The games were bad. The technology was not there yet. Like we needed them as important stepping stones, but let there be no illusions to anybody. The Atari 2600 and its games weren't very good. Boy, I'm going to get in all kinds of trouble today.
All right. I'm taking a shot from my current geek shot glass to get through this. They weren't very good, but you could say the same things about these Nintendo games.
It's a subjective
compared to
thing.
Games of today. Yeah. It's all about the nostalgia play.
It is.
Like, I actually think, and maybe I'll take heat for this, that Adventure is a good game. Mm-hmm. It's a good puzzle game. If you put that out with like just a modern looking, you don't even have to make it that high res, just a modern looking skin on it, that game plays well on an iPhone right now.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't know that they were so bad or they just look bad in retrospect. The way, like, when you watch a 50s TV show, you're like, wait, that's all they did with that?
Well, you knew it was important at the time because this was better than anything there had ever been, and it felt important. And I was a kid for both, a little older kid, but I was a kid for both of these things. And just looking back, if I'm fair, there was maybe one or two titles on the Atari that stood out or were okay. What was great about Nintendo's effort with 8-bit was they kind of figured it out. Like, they got there and they went, wow, look what we can do here. This is like, this is a bit like maybe an N64 or a PlayStation 2. It's like, we figured it out, guys. We know what's going on now. Here's a console for the masses. And the Atari 2600 in retrospect and what they tried to do after it kind of added up to my whole point, which is, it wasn't that great. We thought it was till something came along that was way better, and then nobody cared anymore, and the company went away, as at least as we know it. So, I don't know. Long live tiny NES knockoff boxes that I can plug into my TV. Oh, and I did the math. You would have paid $199 for a new new Nintendo Entertainment System back in 1986 or 7. Okay, you would have paid. That would have had a pack in probably Mario 1. You would have paid roughly $30 to $40 per game. And how many games, Tom? There's 30?
Yeah.
Okay. So there, just do the math in your head there, folks. That's a big... think of the value you're getting on a thing that's super old and isn't as relevant. But still, like, you're it would have been hundreds of dollars for this thing. Multiple hundreds.
And $60 today would have been more back then, too.
Yeah, you know? I guess that's true. If you account for inflation and all that. But,
like $120.
Yeah. Quickly, before we get out of here on Nintendo, do you think this paves the way for a Super Nintendo nostalgia system? Same sort of idea, yeah. Bundled in? Because that's where I would really want to be. Like the SNES, Super Mario World, Street Fighter 2. Like that was my home when I was 14.
Ocarina of Time. That's Nintendo 64. I'm already jumping ahead to the next one.
If it does well... Yeah, and enough people online have said, "Oh, if this was a Super NES, you'd have had me." Because now we're now getting into, you know, people who are in their 30s and have their expendable income were SNES kids, and us NES kids have, you know, we're a little past that. Yeah. So yeah, for sure.
Look, I'll say it. When the Atari 2600 came out, I'm sure there were those of us saying, "Well, if Nintendo would do an NES version of this, I'd be all into it." So here you go. Yeah, I think there's hope for your idea, Joel.
Yep. Looking forward to our brave new future where Joel's predictions are considered prophecy.
In another example of everything old is new again, Pokemon Go is taking over most of the world, or at least the parts that it's been released in. Sensor Tower estimates Pokemon Go gets 33 minutes of average daily use. That's better than Facebook and Snapchat. SurveyMonkey estimates that 21 million daily active users in the U.S. use it, making it the most popular game in the U.S. in history. It's also making $1.6 million a day, twice the average of casual games per daily active user. And the game is now out in Australia, New Zealand, Portugal, Italy, Spain, the US, Germany, and the UK. They say they want to bring it to 200 countries soon. In South Korea, they're not waiting. Sideloaders have been heading to a border town called Sokcho because Google Maps works there while it's restricted in the rest of the country. A YouTuber named Travis D has figured out how to use an Android emulator called BlueStacks and some GPS spoofing to play the game without leaving his house. U.S. Senator Al Franken has sent a letter to Niantic expressing concern over the amount of information being collected from users, which is a rite of passage for many technologies. And T-Mobile announced it will exempt Pokemon Go data from its mobile plans for the next year if you participate in its Mobile Tuesday promotion thing.
Holy crap. Have we hit peak Pokemon yet?
Well, it's peak Pokemon. Yeah, but what excites me about this is the enhanced reality aspect of the game. That's what's kind of cool.
Yeah, and doesn't it seem like we're about to see a glut, and I think this is an understatement, but we're about to see a crazy glut of copycats, whether they be games or other experiences.
We're already seeing them, especially in markets where they haven't launched. In fact, the number one game in China this week was a legit, there's malware taking advantage of this too, but there was a legit game that emulated Pokemon Go, top of the charts in China.
Yeah, there's something, and this may be the same app, I didn't do the research to find out, but there's something in the U.S. store right now that is, from what I can tell, all in Chinese, right? It looks like Mandarin, but the game's available in the U.S. store, and it looks like, you know, a Pokemon ripoff. It may be similar to that, but these guys are so quick on turnaround on this kind of stuff that I suspect it'll be a whole bunch of them showing up. But also, legitimately, you're going to see, you know, well-thought-out games from companies like Rovio, possibly Zynga, possibly whoever, these bigger companies that are known. Freecell, for example, they make, you know, they have a vested interest in trying to capture what people are interested in, and they all do it every time there's a big thing that happens. Like, I don't know, Clash of Clans was a big deal, and Candy Crush sort of restarted the whole match 3 craze, and why not this? That's to some people sounds like a nightmare, and we're heading toward kind of just an ugly period of junkware. But I see it as an opportunity to see something cool rise to the top. Something's going to come out of that. I don't know what it is, but when numbers are this high and there's this much opportunity, there seems like something good can come out of this.
Well, are you saying like a second mover advantage? Somebody's going to take advantage of what Pokemon Go blazes the trail for and learns and take advantage of that. Makes sense to me.
Sure. That doesn't, and does it maybe a little bit better? Like, I mean, if you take an objective view of that app, It's okay. There's nothing fancy going on. It's kind of junky, and it breaks a lot and crashes a lot.
Its biggest advantage is that it has Pikachu and other Pokemon in it that people remember from their childhood.
Exactly. If we were all this fired up about Niantic games, we'd all be playing Ingress every day at this same level. But why aren't we? I would pick
on you for that, because Ingress required a lot more learning curve. Mm-hmm. So what you're criticizing it for is also one of the things that makes it easy for people to get in and play it.
That's a good point. But I would argue, even if Ingress was simple to the degree that this is, or whatever, or even if you had like a fake game where you captured creatures, I don't think you'd have near the reach that this thing has.
I think you're probably right.
Like, the branding on this is huge. And so, you know, for a game that is, you know, primarily published or developed by them and co-published with the name of the Pokemon company on it, without Nintendo's logo or name anywhere, to have that boost their stock by 7.5 whatever market cap share price thing, and have them and then have all these reports that Apple's making more money per microtransaction than Nintendo does based on this deal. If this does anything, Joel, it's wake up Nintendo and say, my gosh, you guys, freaking mobile is the most fertile ground ever. Come out here and more, give us more things.
Yeah, I can see this opening up the floodgates for Nintendo on mobile. I remember other games in the past, they didn't have the VR section to it, but it was like, you know, you collect your dragon egg, you hatch your dragon egg, and then it evolves into a lizard and something bigger and bigger until you get a fully developed dragon. Mm-hmm. And I was interested in that just because of the artwork on a mobile game. But if you pair that with the kind of virtual reality that Pokemon Go has got going on. Incidentally, it's not available in Canada yet, so I haven't been able to play it. I know that there's some workarounds, but I haven't had the time to get into it yet. But I want to, because I missed the Pokemon craze. I was too old. Yeah. But it seems like a cool opportunity to get in. And if it's something that you can see other games, I think you guys might have mentioned it on TMS about like a movie tie-ins, like a Ghostbusters. Walk around and catch all the ghosts, or Game of Thrones, you know, dragon eggs and other stuff like that. I think it would be an interesting way to kind of get mobile gamers outside, you know, and that's the thing that I find most interesting about it. We had Hammond and his daughter, Sydney, were on the Citadel Cafe with me on Wednesday night, and Sydney was teaching us like what Pokemon Go was and how to use it and stuff.
Yeah.
And it was awesome. I mean, and as a dad, Hammond was just like, hey, sure, let's go outside and walk around and catch some Pokemon, you know?
Well, there's definitely, Tom and I were talking about this earlier in the week. We're not in that generation either, obviously. We were not the intended target audience of Pokemon when it hit in the 90s and became a sensation in its own right and then sort of permeated everything Nintendo does. And the show, I've maybe seen a clip here and a clip there, like nothing like that. Never seen the movies, the animated films that came out. However, there I am out there hunting for them on my own sometimes, out there with the dog today, just looking for a place to get more balls and more Pokemon hiding in bushes. And
out there with the dog looking for a place to get more balls.
Yep, and something blings. I'm like, oh, look at that. What is it? I don't know, some kind of purple thing with one eye. Oh, that's a Schligamishlax or whatever. Well, I don't know. I have no idea. All I know is I want to catch them all.
Too many Pidgeys.
And I want to be the very best, as the song goes. Yeah, too many Pidgeys. Can we have a... we can have a consensus right now. There are way too many Pidgeys in the world. The world
Shannon
is lousy
Morse
with them.
On DTNS today pointed out that you can not only evolve your Pidgeys, but also trade them to Mr. Willow for candy that you can then use to buff your Pidgeys.
That's correct. You sell the low-end guys and, well, any of them, Pidgeys
included. I am repeating words that I'm not sure I know exactly what they mean.
Also, hey, quick tip, everybody. When you know how sometimes a little green reticule on your Pokemon when you find them is sometimes smaller or larger?
Oh, yeah. I'm throwing it's large.
Yeah, but here's the thing. If you hold down on the ball before you flick it, that circle fluctuates, small, big, like kind of like going in and out. I didn't know that, first of all. I figured that out today.
Yeah.
Second of all, it was confirmed by Niantic that if you throw the ball and hit him while it's at its smallest reticule, you have a better chance of permanently catching it and it won't escape the initial catch.
At the smallest?
At the smallest, because it's more of a skill shot. So if you get the skill shot, you are paid back by it being easier to make sure he doesn't escape.
I see. I always wait for it to be biggest because I have the easier chance of hitting it. But you're saying they won't escape,
right?
Because of the skill shot.
Yeah, and if it's a low end 10 CP Pidgey, you'll get it. But if it's like a 400 CP something that's just some monster rare thing, and you see that and you're like, oh, that thing's clearly more intricate and big. I better try real hard. You want it to be small and nail it. And you'll have a less chance of him getting out.
Thanks for listening to Poke Talk. We'll take our next caller off the air.
I knew we'd go deep on that, but what are you going to do?
Yeah, I got a Pikachu last night. That's all I got to say.
Well done.
Is it illegal in the United States to share your Netflix password now? Mm. No, it is not illegal for you to share your Netflix password. Might be a violation of the terms of service with Netflix. They might be in their rights to cancel your account if they caught you doing it, although it's unlikely that they will. But the reason people are asking this question is on July 5th, the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that after leaving executive search firm Korn Ferry, a man named David Nozall violated the U.S. Computer Fraud and Abuse Act when he asked an employee still at the firm to give him her password so he could access records from the company. The majority opinion states this appeal is not about password sharing and dismisses concerns as hypotheticals about the dire consequences of criminalizing password sharing. They're saying he violated the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, not just because he shared a password, but because he tried to access proprietary information that he knew he was not supposed to access. However, the dissenting judge wrote, this case is about password sharing, and said, you can say all you want, but the way he did the accessing was password sharing, and this could be used as a precedent, et cetera, et cetera. He said it could make millions into unwitting federal criminals, but he was in the minority. So in the end, what the law does is leave the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act up for interpretation, and the subject of future litigation, it doesn't clearly show which way we're going to go.
So, Joel, next time.
And by the way, Dave the Legal Geek will definitely have some information for you at the end of the show.
Yeah, and I have no, I'm terrible at these sorts of things. I have no legal, I haven't taken the bar exam, let's put it that way. And if I did, I would fail miserably. But, I sure didn't like the idea, even though I don't share my passwords and think it's a bad idea, just generally speaking, it's like a bad practice for you to throw your passwords out there to anybody, even if you trust them. Despite that, it seemed a little chilling, the idea that would become a thing that could be considered illegal to do. So I guess I'm glad the minority still thinks that that's true, and the majority went with my thinking, which is this probably shouldn't be an illegal thing. I'm curious
what the majority's saying that, but the dissenting judge is saying it doesn't matter what you say. You just ruled that a guy committed an illegal act for sharing a password. He's like, say all you want. The fact remains.
But isn't that like saying, all right, you robbed a bank. The illegal thing you did was rob the bank. You got there in your friend's car that you borrowed, and you borrowed it because you don't have a car. So you lending a car is now illegal. That's how it sounds to me. And I know,
that's one way of looking at it. That there's no doubt. But what the people who are worried are saying is, now that the precedent is you used a car to get to the bank, and so robbing the bank is illegal, people that future judges might go, well, but part of the you couldn't get to the bank without a car because it's on a road that doesn't allow pedestrians. I mean, the metaphor starts to fall apart, right?
It doesn't, like they often
do. But because he needed the password to get to the data, a future judge might say, well, but that is part and parcel of getting to that data.
Wayne, do you worry about a future where you can't share your passwords with your friends or whatever?
My mom will be upset. Yes.
See, I was going to say the only time I've ever considered it is stuff with my mom. Cause she doesn't know what she's doing. It's hard for her. I can go over there and show her all day how to use Netflix or whatever, but it would be sad if that was illegal. You should be able to share that with your mom, I think.
Now Netflix is of two minds. They've said in public, like, man, we don't really care too much about that. They make money by selling you plans that allow you to do multiple streams at once. So maybe that's what they're thinking. But the terms of service from Netflix do explicitly state that you can't give your password to somebody else.
Oh, I didn't realize that. And I've never done it. So, quit sniffing out my IP, Netflix. Everything's fine here.
Well, I know that password you gave me works great, Scott. Thanks for that.
Oh, shoot. We've done it again. We've said it on the air. Now there's no taking it back. Joel, Canada has Netflix. Do you worry about this?
Canada has Netflix, sort of. It's vastly different than the U.S. But I'm not worried so much about Netflix, but I'm thinking about it in a kind of a business sense. Like, what if you are on a Patreon and it's for a podcast? There's four members of that podcast. All four of you need access to that Patreon. Is it going to become illegal to share the password of that Patreon? Because there's data there. There's a lot of user data there.
That's a good...
Well, and that's where the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act enters in. It is illegal to gain unauthorized access. So you'd be okay as long as one of you is authorized to access that account and authorizes the others to use that password.
Right. Which says that if you're authorized to be inside of your Netflix account and you give some friend your password, they're authorized then, right?
Well... Yeah. Are they, or is Netflix that's up for interpretation, right? Netflix would say, no, we're the ones who decide who's authorized or not to access that account.
Yeah.
But yeah, Ariza, in fact, there's been a law professor suggest that the way it should come down is if you are accessing as an agent of the owner of the account and acting in their best interests, then you should be safe.
Okay. Well,
That would be the way I would agree with.
Well, and Netflix guys allows you to make user accounts inside of it, so you can have separate profiles.
That's true.
Yeah. Under one password, unfortunately.
Yep. Yeah, that's true. So then you get into the nitty gritty of like, well, I had to give my daughter the password so she could sign in and put this extra profile up. Like,
totally.
It's just a weird thing. It's like, how would they even prosecute this? I guess Netflix would have to comply with some. If there was a law that said this and they wanted to actively prosecute it, Netflix would have to tell everyone when people are using this. They'd have to work with authorities to say, hey, we found out like everybody on the street in this suburban area is sharing passwords. And then you'd have a SWAT team go. You know, that doesn't make sense. Well,
what about like a family sharing plan where each individual would have their own password and account, but it would be tied under like a pyramid where someone is going to have the credit card that pays for everything. And then when the kids are old enough to leave home, all their favorites and watched shows and stuff go with them.
Oh, I love that idea. And music services do something somewhat similar.
Slack has got multiple sign in. Kickstarter now has got, you can share your campaign with other users. They're called collaborators. So everybody has their own password and their own set of data tied to their account. But then when you share the information with them, you invite them either to the Slack or to the Kickstarter campaign to say, hey, I allow you access to this campaign, even though you're going to log in with your own password.
Yep. That sounds
anyway, right. The upshot of this is no, you're not going to jail for sharing your password. You might be breaking terms of service. And again, Legal Geek has a really good breakdown of this and why he thinks the judicial system will continue to interpret this narrowly.
Yes. So listen to the end of the show because he'll be right there to tell you.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is shooting vaccine-laden M&Ms from drones at prairie dogs.
It's my favorite story of the week.
That's pretty self-explanatory, right?
It is, like, but why M&Ms? That was never answered the other day when I did DTNS with you. We never talked about why was it specifically M&Ms and not Reese's Pieces or Skittles or something else. Do we know?
Well, here's the deal. Prairie dogs are eaten by ferrets, and prairie dogs get the Sylvatic Plague, and when ferrets eat them, they pass along the Sylvatic Plague to ferrets. So what you need to do is stop the prairie dogs from getting the Sylvatic Plague, and then that also protects the ferrets. And prairie dogs really like peanut butter-covered M&Ms, apparently. The black-footed ferret has been endangered since 1967. They have done things where they go and they just kind of cast them out on the ground and walk around, but you actually can't cover that much ground, and you don't get a good coverage of all the prairie dogs. So the device will shoot peanut butter-covered M&Ms that carry a vaccine and will be flown over the UL Bend National Wildlife Refuge. It shoots them in three different directions and provides way better coverage than hand scattering. They plan to begin this in September.
In a week and a half of pretty gnarly news, both domestically and internationally, this was my favorite story. Because what it tells me is there are people somewhere trying to help out prairie dogs, and they're doing it with candy. It's like the greatest thing ever.
Peanut butter covered M&Ms.
Even better.
I could not find out if they were also peanut M&Ms that were peanut butter covered.
Now, you'd think anybody has data? Like, do you think the M&M company, whoever it is, Hershey's, whoever owns them, has got data that says our numbers jumped when this story went, you know, hit the internet, and now everybody, like, you know, like seeing Reese's Pieces and E.T., Reese's Pieces started
made
selling like crazy.
Reese's Pieces.
Yeah.
In fact, you mentioning that just now made me want to go get Reese's Pieces. Yeah. No, I get that.
Very weird. Wayne, any thoughts on how we want to get our animals to stop having plagues?
No. This one's over my head, guys.
Literally, it's drones flying over your head.
Yeah, it's literally over your head.
Shooting M&Ms at the ground for the benefit of prairie dogs and ferrets.
Well, is the worry that the ferrets would pass something on to us? Because usually humans don't act in this way unless we're directly involved. But I guess maybe not in this case, huh? I don't know. Doesn't sound like it. I hope.
Well, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
I think humans are the cause of the endangerment of the ferrets.
Oh.
So we're trying to fix it.
So it's one big circle of stupidity once again, and we're solving it with candy.
We encroach on their habitat, and then they start running into the Sylvatic Plague, and then there's not enough numbers to survive it, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
All right. One day.
Usually how those things go.
I love it.
I mean, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is shooting vaccine-laden peanut butter-covered M&Ms from unmanned aerial vehicles at prairie dogs to protect ferrets.
Yeah.
The headline writes itself.
I was going to say.
Hopefully, very long headline. Of the Valkyries in the background.
Yeah. Oh, right. My gosh. No, please. Absolutely. That's an amazing idea. There is something here about Ghostbusters. Are we doing this?
Yeah. I got a chance to see Ghostbusters, which is out in the U.S. today, but I got to see it last Friday in a sneak peek at the YouTube Space LA where my wife works. And I liked it. And apparently is a very controversial opinion to have in this day and age. But I wanted to talk a little bit about like what your guys' expectations of Ghostbusters was, what you thought, et cetera. The summary of my impression was I really was confused by that first trailer. The second trailer was okay, but I didn't have high hopes. And when I saw the movie, I'm like, well, yeah, all of this stuff is contextual. It starts off with the really tall, geeky guy, Jared from Silicon Valley. He was also in The Office doing a tour of a haunted mansion, which is hilarious. Mm. He talks about, like, you know, back in the day, they had these high fences built to keep the Irish out. stuff like that. Yeah. So it's funny from the beginning. The characters are well done. They're funny. They're not carbon copies of the original Ghostbusters. They have their own storyline to tell, but there's plenty of fan service, including a look at the fire station and why in today's Manhattan, there's no way they can afford that fire station. That's all explained in the movie. About halfway through, it starts to bog down. It loses its way a little bit. I feel like they definitely didn't stick the landing. But overall, an enjoyable experience, and I had a good time watching it.
Anyone else see it yet? Wayne, you're the effects guy.
Or just what your expectations?
Well, I actually got to see it about 2 months ago. I was hanging out in the Sony lot with a buddy of mine.
Oh, cool.
And he got us to see it. And I agree with you. I thought it was very funny. The only thing I didn't really like about it is that it had no connection to the original series. And that was kind of a bummer.
Even the cameos are they're all cameos in very different roles than they were.
Yeah, they're not. So it's not like Peter Venkman shows up. It's, you know, or whoever.
Bill Murray shows up, but not as Peter Venkman.
Right. That was weird to me that they decided not to do that. But maybe I guess they want to make it their own thing. And I totally get it. But there's a big Stay Puft Marshmallow Man in this, right? We've seen it in the commercials.
It's a big Ghostbuster logo.
Oh, really?
That's what I talk about. The second half is not as tight. The second half, I'm like, okay, maybe.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Joel, are you which camp are you in? They're ruining my childhood or I'm open-minded?
I'm open-minded if it's good. I find in general Hollywood has a hard time impressing me with remakes. But I'm open-minded. I don't think they're ruining anything, especially if it's a complete divergence. Like if they're not trying to just remake it, if they're doing their own thing, all the power to them. Yeah. I haven't seen it yet though. It's on my list, but I just haven't had time.
Yeah.
Wayne, I'm curious what you thought of Holtzman, Kate McKinnon's character.
That was the saving grace of the whole movie. Yeah. I loved her.
Heard amazing things about her in that.
100% agree. She steals every scene she's in. And when I talk about like they're not carbon copies of the original Ghostbusters, her character is nothing I would have even imagined in relation to a Ghostbusters movie, and it's hilarious.
Well,
no, and I don't even think you could have wrote that character. Like she does so much stuff with just the looks and like all of that. It's just, it's amazing.
Yeah, really, really
Kate
is.
Kate McKinnon is a national treasure. I'm also going to just say this one final thing about it. They already ruined Ghostbusters another time for me. So this is all new to me and doesn't need to be ruined. And how'd they do that? They made Ghostbusters 2. Anyway, let's move on with the show. Take that, Ghostbusters 2 fans. That movie sucked and you all know
it. Yes, you burned Ghostbusters 2. That'll alert them.
That thing was terrible. Tom, people give us cool articles to help us out with the show all the time. Who were they week?
No, go to currentgeek.reddit.com. More than any other show I do, your votes on the subreddit inform exactly what we do on the show. Another Jay Martin, hometown rival, and Captain Kipper were among the many people who submitted awesome stories for today's show, and we appreciate it.
We really do. Okay, real quick, I wanted to talk to you guys about who you are and what you're doing. So, Wayne, you're an effects guy, film guy, busy guy, it sounds like, and have all kinds of cool stuff going on, but also working on some VR projects. Tell us what you're up to. What's going on?
Well, I'm currently finishing off some visual effects on a movie called The Dark Rite, which is like a witches and warlock movie. Mm. And we did some magic effects and things like that that's supposed to be coming out. There's another big movie we're working on. I'm not allowed to talk about it, but it's connected to a big name director, and we're remaking one of his early films. Ooh. And that
I was going to jokingly say Star Wars, but that would
be No. And that starts shooting in September. Which is going to be a big deal. And let's see, what else am I doing? I'm currently working for a company making a cartoon for Amazon. And then I spent the last 6 months helping NBC kind of invent how they're going to use virtual reality for their E! Online network.
Ooh, see, I'm very curious about that. I doubt there's a ton you can say about it, but it sounds like they're getting on board. They're interested in what VR can do for their market, for their viewers, right?
Yeah, that's the big part about it. And I think the big question that everybody has, especially if you're talking about NBC, is not only how you can use it, but the biggest question is how they can monetize it and how they can get their users to kind of like learn about it. Because with E! Specifically, we're talking about the Kardashian generation getting introduced to virtual reality.
Yeah.
And how they're going to kind of, you know...
Yeah,
and I'm demographic. so that's all part. Yeah.
But the key question that everybody is trying to solve is, how do you tell a story in virtual reality? Whether you're doing fiction or whether you're doing nonfiction, like how do you tell that story? I mean, what kinds of things did you think about in helping them solve that?
The biggest things we started thinking about is how we would use sound and dialogue and how we would restage our action, so that you were automatically directing the viewer to where you wanted them to look, almost like a live interactive play. Here in Minneapolis, they do a play called Tony and Tina's Wedding. They might do it other places, but you go to this wedding and you're in it. And so that's kind of how we started thinking about virtual reality and telling stories like a immersive play. Mm. But then you have to think about, you know, your environment. You can't... you literally can see 360 degrees above and below and behind, and so you can't shoot it in a studio. You have to have an entire 360 set built, or you have to do it on a 360 location. And so those are huge challenges to the narrative aspect of it. And then cutting is weird. We did a whole bunch of experiments where we cut between two different cameras or three different camera setups, and you can still cut on the action, but there's no way to guarantee that the audience is looking at that action when you cut.
Yeah.
So the cuts become jarring.
Yeah.
Moving camera is a huge problem. If you put virtual reality stuff, a camera on a person, the handheld effect that we get from, you know, like Blair Witch is amplified 100 times. And so you definitely feel like you want to puke as soon as that happens. So moving camera is difficult.
I got a question for you about this is purely logistical, and I don't know why I can't get it out of my head. But if in a traditional scene, you've got a set and you've got crew and then you've got lighting and you have actors, and you kind of know your field of view and you know where things are cut off, and this fake wall to this house that doesn't actually exist is off camera. So unless you goof and actually show part of it, the illusion is maintained. When you're doing 360 degree video, and we're not talking about, you know, rendered video game video, we're talking about actual video here in 360 degrees or at least 180, you have this much larger chance of showing how the sausage is made constantly. How do you have crew involved at all? Like, where are they standing? How do they stay out of the view of this 360 degree camera?
Yeah, they have to be offset, basically, and you have just your actors on set, and then you still have to hide whatever rig you have attached to your camera. So, because if you look down and you have a tripod, you're going to see the tripod, or if you have it attached to some kind of any kind of a crane or dolly or anything like that, you're going to see all of that equipment. And so the only way to get around that is to, like I said, have that 360 set. And everybody's gone and everything is practical. All your lights are practical. All of your everything you're seeing is there. And that's the only way to get around that. Or what I've been experiencing or experimenting with my crew is doing compositing on 360 degree video footage.
Oh, interesting.
Which we've been doing in After Effects with some success, but it's multiplied. When you bring it into After Effects, you end up with basically a cube. You're like, imagine you're inside a box and you have all those six sides. And if you can still rotoscope and you can track and you can composite, but you have to do it to all six sides.
Oh, man.
And if they overlap any of those seams, then the problem becomes 100 times harder.
Yeah,
because you have to figure out that overlap.
It sounds like just the tool sets and the thinking behind how films are made. It's just a whole different kind of thinking. I mean, I know that I've talked to game developers who have said this about game mechanics and how games work. Some of them the same problems. Like, how are you keeping the focus of somebody who can look anywhere they want, anytime they want? How are you making sure they saw this thing that needed to be seen to carry things forward? Obviously, that's, you know, sounds 10 times harder in 360 degree video, but it sounds also like, as challenging as all that sounds, it sounds like this must be really fun and rewarding, and like you're on the edge of something, maybe a whole new way of telling stories and doing narratives.
Oh, absolutely. Because I think what we're going to try, and I'm actually going to be shooting a short to test this theory, but you could actually shoot it from the point of view of multiple characters and then actually set it up so that the audience could experience the story or the narrative multiple times by going back and watching it from the different characters' points of view.
Mm. Oh, wow.
And so now you have this immersive story that happens, and let's say you have, you know, an ensemble cast of four or five people. That narrative, the main narrative happens, but everybody's got their subplots. And now I can come back and watch that movie four times and experience what those individuals felt like.
That's
so it's
cool.
An idea.
Yeah.
I don't know if it'll work, but I'm going to find out.
Well, it strikes me there's two main things to deal with. One is we're going back to the beginning on movie making, because it was a hack to put lights and crew behind the camera when people realized, hey, the camera can't see anything back there. We can do all kinds of tricks because that doesn't work anymore in 360 degree. So we kind of have to start over. But at the same time, you gain all of these new capabilities that you would have never had.
Right, but then it comes back to telling a really good story and having really good performances from your cast. You have to have good actors.
Yeah, either way, I like that constant runs through this, kind of. Yeah. There's something anchoring about it. Like, if this isn't acted well or performed well or written well, then what are we doing? You know, like, there's no point either way. So that's really, really interesting. Well, I can't wait to hear more. At the end of the show, we'll give you a chance to drop some links on us and let people know where they can find more about what you got going on. Joel, cartoonist man Joel of the Great White North, busy doing all kinds of stuff. You got a Kickstarter going right now that my daughter in particular was very excited about. Why don't you tell folks about it?
Sure. Well, I'm an artist myself, but recently I've gotten more and more into publishing. It was brought about by my interviews and stuff on Comics Coast to Coast, and Piper Thibodeau is the first artist that I'm working with my company Forge Publishing. And the way that we're approaching it is there's traditional publishing models and there's self-publishing, where, you know, the artist, if they want to make their own book, has to do all the work, all the crowdfunding and all that kind of stuff, talking to printers. And I'm trying to find this middle ground where I can help an artist that's far too busy, like Piper, who's doing a daily painting every day for the last 4 years, who's freelancing for companies like DreamWorks and Nickelodeon, and help them make a book. And that's what this Kickstarter is about. And the short link, if you go to forgepublishing.com, you'll see a link to hit the Kickstarter and check it out, see what you guys think. But for me, it's been really rewarding working with Piper, because this is something that she wouldn't be able to do with a little bit of help. Mm-hmm. And it's nice to be able to work with someone who's fairly new to the industry. She's got some experience, but she's kind of just finished school not 2 or 3 months ago. So it's really cool to kind of be there at the ground floor. And I read a quote online recently, and it was like, if something along the lines of, be the person who you needed when you were younger. And I just, it really rang true, because like when I was coming up, and I've done the self-publishing thing, I've published a book, and I wish that I had someone that had a lot more information around when I did it. And so being able to pay that forward and help artists out is really the mission behind Forge. Especially if we can get the artists a much larger cut than a traditional publishing model, which is something I'd like to do.
Yeah, that's super rad. People will learn here shortly how they can find that Kickstarter and support it. And just as a side note, my daughter had already followed Piper's work somewhere, Instagram or somewhere. Yeah. And she said, wait, what's he doing? And I explained it, and she got all riled up and excited about it. So
awesome.
She already has fans, as best I can tell.
That's fantastic, man. I love that idea of saying, yeah, you can do it all yourself, but you shouldn't have to choose between doing it all yourself or handing over control entirely to someone else, like a publisher. There should be a middle ground. That's brilliant.
Yeah, it's really cool, man.
And as an artist, I mean, Piper's retaining copyright for her book. So it, like, all of that kind of stuff, it's creator-owned, it's independent, it's a small print run. We're printing in the U.S. because that's where most of Piper's fans are. So, like, we're trying to keep it as local as possible, but then also kind of create enough of a momentum forward that Piper then has an investment of books that she can sell at cons and everything else down the line.
Yeah. By the way, side note, Piper Thibodeau is the coolest name for like a future kids book author or something ever. So
yeah,
let's encourage people like that, folks. All right. What's now? Oh, I know what's now. Check this out. It's the pop quiz.
America scores and wins.
All right. It's the pop quiz. Oh, there's our music for it. Check that out in the background. It's a chance for us to quiz our guests in areas of their expertise. They get an option to answer these questions correctly or wrongly. If they get it right, if they get it wrong. And either way, Tom keeps score, and we'll tell them how they do against each other and against themselves at the end of this.
Against themselves.
I don't know, make this
you up lost time. Yourself.
I'm going to start this week with Wayne. Wayne, your topic is 70s action movie trivia.
Fun.
All right. It sounds like it's your bag of chicken. I'm excited to give these to you. Here you go. Number one. And these are short, so this is nice and easy. Who is the villain in the original Dirty Harry film?
Oh, the serial killer, Scorpio.
That is correct. Well done. Scorpio is correct. Where is it? Oh, who sang
the theme? We need to change the music to 70s action music.
I know. I don't think I have that. Do I have that somewhere? I might actually have something like that. Oh, here you go. How about this?
There we go.
Yeah, this is pretty good. All right. That's what we'll have in the background today. That's a little more game showy, but I don't know.
It started off fairly action, but then,
Hey, it's the 70s. It's a game show. What are you going to do? Next question. Who sang the theme song to James Bond /007 film Diamonds Are Forever?
I can hear it in my head.
Diamonds are forever.
I don't know. I don't know.
All right. The answer to that is incorrect. The answer is Shirley Bassey. Shirley Bassey.
I would have never guessed.
She also
I'm going to give you a point for answering honestly. I don't know. But then you lose a half point for not remembering Shirley Bassey, who is a legend.
She was a legend. She's still around, though, isn't she? I thought she was. No?
Yeah.
Okay.
She'll always be a legend, Scott.
All right. She's a legend.
Even when she dies.
All right, good. She also did the gold finger. That's her, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, she's really good at that. All right, next up. What year was the original Gone in 60 Seconds released? Not the 2000 movie, but the newer one. Or the older one.
The original one.
Yeah.
I'm going to say 74.
You are correct. Nicely done.
Damn.
Nailing it. Second last question.
Half point uncertainty bonus.
Who played John Shaft in the original Shaft films from 1970s? From the
1970s. Talking about
Shaft.
Yep. Oh, I don't know.
It is Richard Roundtree is the correct answer. Richard Roundtree, as opposed to his brother Barry Squaretree. All right. Final question. Who directed the 1976 film Assault on Precinct 13? Venerable '70s director.
Yeah.
It's an action '70s game show.
Do I get a lifeline?
You get no.
It's a harsh. Scott is a harsh quizmaster.
I really am.
All right, then no, I don't remember.
All right, I'm going to say that it is John Carpenter is the correct answer. John,
really?
Yeah, I know. Surprised me too.
Now I'm mad at myself.
Yeah, I would have not gotten that right if that helps at all. And I love '70s movies too. All right, there's your questions. Hold tight because we got some for Joel. Joel, your topic is Gilmore Girls. Because you just finished this thing or something, right?
Yep.
Okay. All right. You just binged it on Netflix. So apparently you do get that in Canada, which is great. All right, here you go. Gilmore Girls trivia. First question. Who created the Gilmore Girls? I will give you a hint.
Credits.
Well, I won't give you a hint. Never mind.
It's a woman, and I
that was
don't
my
recall
hint.
Her name.
My hint was she was a woman. Oh, you're somewhere near the... You're at the edge, but you're wrong. It is Amy Sherman Palladino.
Palladino. I knew it was an Italian name.
Yeah. That's a spicy meatball. All right, next up. How many seasons of the show are there? This does not include the upcoming revival, so the current number of seasons out.
7.
You are correct. Nicely done.
You get 1.7 points for that.
Yeah, that was fast. And the 0.7... Oh, because 7 seasons. I get it.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm a little slow. What was the name of the first episode of the Gilmore Girls?
I don't know. I don't remember.
The answer is literally pilot. So there's that. I know.
Yeah. Oh, wait, so you're going to get an honesty point for saying you don't know, but then lose a half point for, come on, guess pilot if you never know the first episode of anything.
That's right. Second to last question. What is the name of the first episode of the third season of the show? That's not fair.
Pilot part 3.
Yeah. So third season.
Doesn't seem fair, does it?
Oh.
I don't know if there's
Yale?
What was it again? Say it again.
Yale.
That is incorrect. It is Those Hazy... Lazy, Hazy, Crazy Days.
Oh, that song. Yeah.
That's the one. Final question. Scott Patterson plays what character on The Gilmore Girls?
Luke Danes.
Oh, my. That was awful quick, dude. I'm a little worried about how much you earned at Luke Danes.
Well, characters are the meat of that show, and that's where all my brain real estate is.
I completely agree.
No, that makes sense.
All right, Tom, they have all answered questions. They both have, not all, because there'd be more than two. How'd they do?
Yeah, with a maximum score possible of 5, very close, right down to the wire. Wayne with 3, Joel with 3.2.
Oh, Joel edged it out, dude. My gosh. If it wasn't for that pesky John Carpenter question, man, that thing was a bummer. All right, there's that. Let's do a little look into the future.
The future promises even more startling things to come.
All right, this is the part of the show we call Forecast. A long time ago, it used to be a show on its own, but now we've squeezed it into here as a segment, and I've got a forecast, a pick for the future today that I want to share with everybody. One day, we will stop terrorist acts and other horrible things, other acts of violence, especially large-scale ones, with satellite response systems. I spelled terrorist wrong. I spelled it terrorist. Taroist. Anyway, with satellite response systems, and let me explain. So it's not just simply a satellite will see something going down that looks suspicious and stop it. We are going to, one day, we're talking maybe 50 years in the future, we'll have a technology that, let's just call it a stasis technology. And a Russian satellite or American satellite, or it doesn't matter, something's going to be crossing over a certain part of the world and go, oh, look what's going on right there. Those four trucks heading that direction, that's bad. That's a sign of something being weird. Now, in today's world, you'd have to do arrests and you'd have to make assumptions, and that leads to profiling. And before you know it, nobody really knows when somebody's doing something wrong or if it was just a big mistake. So what we do is these satellites have these, this is the Star Trek part, but have these beams that create stasis fields around the possible offenders and holds them. And they have to have a certain level of, you know,
confidence.
What do you call it when a cop thinks probable cause?
Yeah. Okay.
There has to be enough of that. I don't know how you legally do that. Maybe there's other technologies at play that make that quicker, you know, a little more precoggy or something. But the point is that you put these trucks into stasis. Suddenly they can't go anywhere. Nobody's hurt. Nobody's harmed. The people driving the trucks, anybody involved, they're just in a stasis field. They can't leave, and then no one can enter until the problem's resolved. And that can be handled on the ground. They come up and say, all right, show us, you know, what you got in there. And they open their truck and they show them and they look, oh, okay, it looks like they're just passing through. They have all the legal papers. Everything's fine. Or you guys have, you know, a fertilizer bomb in the back of your truck. We caught you. The law wins today. To me, that's the way it seems a little sci-fi, I realize that, but we get to a place where we're not just waiting for the next horrible thing to happen, that we have a way of seeing it before it happens, but not causing preemptive loss of life or preemptive loss of, of property, some cool way in technology to just stop it, kind of almost stop in time, but just saying, don't move, give us 10 minutes, we'll work this out. Okay, you guys are good. It's off again. Now, I realize it could be totally abused, but I'd love your thoughts. Tom, what do you think of my idea?
Yeah, I love the stasis field idea, right? If you can be confident, if you have the probable cause, all that stuff, to say like, hold on, let's stop this. I don't want to get too much into the disturbing events, but you could stop a vehicle that you know is up to no good before it carries out most of its no good. And I see the beauty in that idea, right? And I don't know if such a thing is even possible, but I want it to be too. Sure. Let's figure out how to make that happen. And of course, there's all kinds of conversations to be had about, well, that could also be used for ill. Terrorists could use it to stop whole populations so that they could kill them easier. So yes, they're going to have to be safeguards, et cetera, no different than any other weapon. The problem I have with it, though, is this preemptive strike capability of it. That would require machine intelligence that is able to tell that an act is bad before it gets to the point where it has caused damage. And to me, it just feels like if we can do that, we can probably stop these things before you need the stasis field.
That's a good point.
Like, it's such a fine point to say, well, the machine intelligence is good enough to catch them when they're about to do it, where we can use the stasis field, but not good enough to catch them before. I feel like we could probably just have the machine intelligence, if we can get to that side of the equation, be able to tell the cops, like, go to this address, you'll find the bomb making and the plans there.
Once again, very reasonable response, probably the better way to go. Wayne, anything to add to this utopian ideal?
Well, I like the stasis field thing. I want to make a movie about that. Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
But I have to agree. I think the technology that would be required to, like, figure out what was going to happen, before, like Minority Report, basically, is what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And where we know, oh, wait a minute, they're going to commit a murder. They're murderers before they're murderers. That, to me, is a little dangerous.
Yeah, which is, I guess, the whole point of Minority Report, making a stare into the void of that and say, that's an interesting moral quandary, isn't it? I mean, that's I get that. Like, Tom's point about somebody getting a hold of a stasis field that could stop, say, oh, I don't know, let's say they could stop an airliner in the middle of the air and then just let go of it, and then the airliner can't correct or whatever. Nobody wants that. I just like the idea of being able to go, you know what it's like? What's his name in The Incredibles, the bad guy? something zone, whatever his name was, bad guy. Syndrome. Thanks. Son's over there. He did the same thing. So when he wanted to stop people, thanks, Nick. When he wants to stop people, he would shoot out this stasis field and they just couldn't go anywhere or do anything. Now, I realize I'm describing a villain doing that to our heroes, and that kind of maybe goes against what I'm trying to say. But Joel, is there any validity to this idea in your mind?
Well, I like the idea of real life zero point energy, which if my Pixar nerd is correct, I think that's what he uses. But what I took from what you said would be, if it's successful, forget how it gets there, but if it works, we would no longer have to profile. So if profiling is no longer part of society at large, I'm wondering if that eventually would just reduce terrorist attacks to begin with. Because if the people aren't profiling, wondering if you're a terrorist or not, and you're not being pushed down, then the idea of a lot of terrorist attacks is usually to make a statement, minority groups, you know, like rogue factions doing their thing. But if they're not being profiled, I'm wondering if long-term effects might be that they don't have to do terrorist acts.
Yeah, it's just hard to...
I think there's more than just profiling behind most terrorist organizations, unfortunately. Yeah. And the other point I'd say is any machine intelligence that can do what Scott wants is profiling. It's just doing it much better. Like, all profiling means is we are looking at people we have a very high likelihood of causing trouble. Where profiling is bad is where, and the only information we're basing that on is what country they're from. And so you get way more false positives than helps, and it ends up just being racism.
Yeah.
But profiling done well, which some countries actually can do, says, well, we're not going to go just on their religion or their ethnicity or even where they're from. We're going to go on all these other data points. And all Scott's saying is, let's make the data points even richer and the intelligence behind them even better at narrowing them down.
Yeah, and I'm going to say right now, I am 100% sure that swaying public opinion in this direction, that this would ever be a thing that people would be cool with, I realize is a tall order, okay? So, like, having everybody say, yeah, we'll let them. I mean, they're barely sort of kind of getting close to saying, yeah, maybe we want self-driving cars, maybe, but you got to prove to us that no one ever dies ever from a self-driving car. Which is proving, right.
Even though people die crazy all the time in regular driven cars, we can't let self-driving cars kill anybody.
Yes, but if you take, let's just say society finally stops doing that, which seems impossible to me because self-preservation is part of our genetic evolutionary makeup and we're not going to change.
Hey, we're not still on horses, so we've made the jump once.
Yeah, we did. So anyway, I don't know. I don't know what the future holds, but hey, stasis fields, catch it.
I want to see the movie that Wayne helps get made.
I do too, dude.
Yeah,
just call it Stasis. Cool. Call it Stasis.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, you're all set.
I'll do it.
All right, I'll look for my credit in the final credits. Just kidding. Let's do a quick phone call. We get phone calls at 801-471-0462, or you can email your questions or thoughts to currentgeek@gmail.com. We got a quick call about alternate routes.
Hi, this is Gary Fisher, the senior geek. It would be nice if mapping apps, say Waze, could set up some kind of a mesh network among Waze users in data sparse areas so that if you get trapped in a traffic jam where there's no data coverage, that it could be reported back and people might be able to find an alternate route. Just a thought. Thanks.
So Waze does this over time, not instantaneously. What he's asking for is an instantaneous change, right? Like there's a horrible accident up here. Immediately, everybody on this quote-unquote mesh network would be notified and people could find alternate routes. But Tom, isn't part of the problem these devices aren't forming a mesh network because they're not designed to, or they're not?
Well, yeah, but that doesn't mean they couldn't. Or maybe there could be a little add-on. I love this idea to say like, hey, and it could be used in rural areas too, where people are like, well, this is no good to me because it drops out for this long period of time. If you've got just enough people in your rural area that you can get to use it, you can all, you know, mesh network off of each other. Again, critical access or, you know, a critical mass is needed. And maybe in rural areas that becomes harder. But yeah, I love that idea. Also, really, the best part of this is that that's a great idea. And I hope somebody pursues that. And he is in the chat room right now saying, I don't even remember recording this.
Oh, Gary,
but
you're the best.
Whether you remember it or not, Gary, it's an excellent thought. I love the idea.
Gary, you're the best. Always willing to embrace his waning memory. I love Gary. Well, that brings us to the end of the show, everybody. Again, emails, easy, currentgeek@gmail.com, 801-471-0462 for your voicemails. let's, before we get out of here, let our guests tell people where they can find their stuff. So let's start over there with Joel. Where can people go find this Kickstarter and get going with this thing?
Sure. So it's called Daily Paintings, The Art of Piper Thibodeau on Kickstarter. But the quick links are forgepublishing.com or follow at forgepublishing on Twitter. And all links will lead to the Kickstarter.
Very exciting. Best of luck on that. I think it looks like a great project.
Thanks, man.
Wayne, where can people see more of what you got going?
Just go to my website, intothevoidfx.com.
Nice.
And you can find a whole bunch of stuff there. Yeah. All right.
Very cool. You guys have been awesome guests. Thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, you guys were awesome. Tom Merritt, anything to add? Anything you'd like to say?
Yeah, just real quick. If you or someone you know has been thinking lately, how do I cut the cord? Do yourself a favor. Go to tommerrittbooks.com, two R's, two T's, find The Brief Guide to Cord Cutting, and get it for 99 cents. If you're buying it for a friend or a family member, it's 99 cents. And it gives you all of the options here in the United States for cutting the cord laid out in, like, what are the questions you need to think about? What are the services? What are the devices? And what devices do you need to get the services you want? It's all there. Brief Guide to Cord Cutting, TomMerrittBooks.com.
Yep. Don't forget to follow him on Twitter at Ace Detect as well. Follow me at Scott Johnson. I made a book. It's a coloring book. That's right. You can color drawings I've done. And if you're interested in doing that, they're based on a lot of the art I've done over the last 15 years for my webcomic, My Extra Life, at MyExtraLife.com. The coloring book can be found at frogpants.com/store. And I think you'll like it. People dig it. I like it. And I think you'll like it too. So go check that out. That's going to do it for us. We'll be back next time with a brand new episode. In the meantime, big thanks to everybody for being here. Our live audience, of course. You guys are always amazing. Big thanks to, who else? Andrew Allen does our theme music. Thanks to Todd Whitehead and Alpha Geek Radio and DiamondClub.tv. All you guys are amazing as well. Don't forget, currentgeek.com is the website. Currentgeek.reddit.com. Submit your own stories there. And yeah, it's going to do it for us. For me, for our guests, for Tom. We'll see you next time.
Hi, and welcome back to Legal Geek. This week, we cover the new scrutiny placed on the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. The CFAA was written in 1986 to criminalize hacking activities with respect to government computers and computers of financial institutions. The law also has a catch-all provision added in 2008 that prohibits access without authorization or by exceeding authorized access to any protected computer which is used in interstate commerce, which can be read as anything connected to the internet. This amendment, while made by Congress in efforts to solidify the anti-hacking law, have created questions of how broadly this law should actually be interpreted. If broadly interpreted, seemingly innocuous things like breaking a social network's code of conduct or letting someone use your Netflix password would be a federal felony. The Ninth Circuit's decision this week in U.S. v. Nozal illustrates both sides of the argument well. The facts in Nozal are pretty simple. Nozal left an executive recruiting firm to open his own competitor firm, and over time he took a couple of former co-workers and his assistant from the original company as well. Nozal instructed the former co-workers, while they still had access, to pull confidential lead information from the old company's servers and give it to him for his new company. Then after those co-workers also left and had their own access revoked, Nozal had his former assistant give her password to them, and they accessed similar information again to deliver it for the new firm. The former assistant left for the new firm shortly thereafter. This is actually the second time this case and set of facts has been decided by the Ninth Circuit. The first time, back in 2012, the full en banc panel considered specifically the actions of the former co-workers who downloaded and transferred confidential data and gave it to Nozal while they were still employed by the original company and still had full access to the information. That panel determined that these employees did have access, so the conduct was clearly not without authorization, and it also wasn't deemed exceeding authorized access because they did have full access to that information. Certainly the transfer to Nozal broke employee codes and therefore violated contract or trade secret laws, but not a law designed to stop outside or inside hacking. Just 4 years later, a smaller three-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit essentially reversed this decision based solely on a small change in the facts considered. Specifically, this year the court focused on the activities of the co-workers after they had been fired with their access revoked, but they used the assistant's authorized password anyway to access the database and pull more information. Instead of focusing on the fact that this was just another type of password sharing, and essentially the same access done by the assistant, the new panel decided to call this slightly altered conduct as clearly falling under the without authorization prong of the law, generalizing this story as a hacking scheme with an inside man. However, as the dissent of the current decision notes, this decision could be extended to apply to all password sharing, including things like giving your buddy an HBO Go password. This case is not necessarily over, as a full-on bonk panel of the Ninth Circuit could go back and reverse this new decision to make it more consistent with the first one, which narrowly interpreted the scope of the CFAA. Moreover, as the Second and Fourth Circuits have sided with the narrow interpretation of the law, while three other circuits have sided with the broad interpretation, this is a classic case of circuit split of opinion, which usually brings swift action by the Supreme Court to settle the issue, so stay tuned for further developments. The bottom line is, the cries that sharing passwords for consumer things like streaming services is now a felony is not exactly true, as that type of fact scenario has not been applied to this law yet. Even though it can be painful to watch the judicial branch labor over how to interpret what laws Congress enacts while trying to keep up with technology, this is how the process is designed to work. With so many other potential laws like contract, tort, and trade secret laws being available to stop smaller breaches like password sharing, and the original intent to stop hacking with the CFAA, it seems like the eventual solution of the judiciary will be a narrow interpretation of this law. It just takes a while, with some bumps on the road to get there. Thanks for listening. If you will be at Gen Con in Indianapolis in August, come check out my seminars on IP law and game design, or message me on Twitter at BuckeyeFitzy, and we can meet up for a drink or a game.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network. Get more at frogpants.com.